WFAE streaming is sponsored by Corporate Information Technologies, a local IT company assisting business and taking a proactive approach to technology. CIT, let us show you how good IT can be. corp-infotech.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins.
There's got to be a morning after if we can hold on through the night. We have a chance to find the sunshine. Let's keep on looking for the light.
Well, that's what pundits, news reporters, voters, and probably the various candidates in their campaigns were thinking last night. Well, the light broke this morning, really early this morning, about 2:30, I think it was. This is the morning after. The campaign commercials have stopped. The election is over. We can all breathe a little easier. Or can we? I suppose that depends on how you feel about the outcome. And this hour, we're taking a closer look at the outcome. We're joined, as we were during the Democratic convention and again during our election preview show on Monday, by three of the WFAE news reporters who have followed the local and state races carefully for the duration of the campaign: Julie Rose, Michael Tomczyk, and Lisa Miller. And we'll be joined later by our go-to political scientists, Drs. Eric Heberlig and Michael Bitzer. Thanks for being back. I think one of the surprises of the evening, and I'd like to get your take on it, was the fact that they called the governor's race in North Carolina really early.
That was fast. I was thinking maybe around 10:30 we hear, but by 9 o'clock, Governor-elect Pat McCrory was up there at the podium making his victory speech. He said around 8:45 that Walter Dalton had called to concede, but it was very fast, and it ended out being much like the polling. It was a double-digit lead. It was 43% Dalton and 55% McCrory.
You know, Mike, I was at the Democratic Party, Mecklenburg County Democratic Party last night at Dilworth Grill. And what was funny kind of to me, clearly people knew that Walter Dalton, he was in Raleigh having his event. So this was, you know, sort of the Charlotte folks, many of them. But, you know, I was hearing kind of whisperings that people at this party had sort of secretly voted for McCrory, but don't tell anybody, you know. and when on one of the TV screens there at the Dilworth Bar and Grill, McCrory started talking, it was on mute, right? And I think it kind of went unnoticed that he'd actually just given his acceptance speech. You know, the Democrats there were and then sort of news trickled down. Oh, yeah, they called it Dalton lost. Darn, you know. Mm-hmm. But there was so much focus on other races, the big outcomes of the night. It was, I think the Democrats knew.
Yeah, they knew for a long time.
Yeah, they knew they'd lost it. And so they kind of just didn't make much mention of it last night.
Did Pat McCrory win on his ideas, on his name recognition after running for this office for a fairly long time, because he almost won last time? His record in Charlotte, the fact that the state has been trending Republican the last couple of years, why do you think, what put him over the top?
Well, the night was really good for the Republicans in North Carolina. I mean, the state went Romney as well, and so I think that had a lot to do with it.
And
running for 4 years as well.
Right, and Walter Dalton had the disadvantage of really not knowing until early this year that Governor Perdue was not going to run, which by all accounts did sort of catch the Democrats by surprise.
And he alluded to that in his speech last night as well. Hey, I only had a few months.
And here's a guy who is not technically part of the Perdue administration, as Governor Mayor McCrory has tried to paint him all this time, but he is the lieutenant governor to Governor Perdue, who has been very unpopular. And so he had that additional burden to kind of try to overcome. I mean, he had a lot of hurdles.
Yeah. Did he carry Mecklenburg County, Pat McCrory?
He actually did by just a slim amount. It was about 2,500 votes.
Of course, Charlotte is not all of Mecklenburg County, but it's pretty much all of Mecklenburg County, and he didn't carry it in 2008. So, and he was a very popular mayor here for 14 years. Why does he keep not carrying or almost losing Mecklenburg County in this case?
Well, Mecklenburg County has a lot of Democrats in it as well. You heard from Julie, too, that there sounded like there was quite a few Democrats who also voted for McCrory. But it was slim. In a lot of urban areas, you know, it is a heavy Democrat vote.
This will be the first time in a long time, I think. Is it the first in almost a century, almost 100 years, that the state government will be controlled by Republicans? Mm-hmm. Is that right?
That's right.
Is Pat McCrory cut from the same cloth as the Republicans down east and the Republicans who have controlled the legislature the last several years?
Well, Tom Tillis is just from Mecklenburg County as well, up the road. So they may have things in common.
I think something we heard in Lisa's report this morning is instructive there that, you know, is he cut from the same cloth as the folks down east? I think regionalism is maybe less the question as urban versus rural. And, you know, McCrory clearly seems to be cut from the same cloth as the other urban folks out there. I mean, he's a big city guy. Charlotte's a city, you know, so there are other urban areas in the state that can definitely connect with him and identify. But, you know, I think that I potentially think that could become more of the issue, that he then gets painted, oh, he doesn't understand the rural areas. He's, you know, as his governing kind of moves forward.
Michael?
And on that point as well, I mean, he made a very specific push as he was kind of building these contacts, another thing that Lisa talked about this morning, throughout the state, to go to these rural areas. I mean, there was this one person, for example, this business owner, small business owner in Elizabethtown in Bladen County, mm-hmm. which is this, you know, it's a tiny town. It's not that big of a county, and it usually votes Democratic. And this guy was impressed that McCrory even came there. You know, I mean, he's got, I mean, this business owner's office, you can kind of hear ducks quacking in the background as we were talking to him. And McCrory went and spent some time there with him. So, I mean, clearly he's at least made the effort to reach out to these folks. So then, of course, the question will be, you know, how do you turn that into governance that kind of looks after the rural and urban interests?
And a lot of these rural areas, too, are turning toward more Republican. So,
well, the question, maybe I phrased the question wrong, because I was curious as to whether or not you think that this Republican mayor of Charlotte, who was fairly progressive in what he did during his time here and the issues that he pushed and sometimes went against the traditional party values of the Republican Party as he pushed these things like light rail, will get along with a legislature, the Republicans in which are from other parts, less urban parts of the state, who maybe don't hold the same opinions of where this state ought to go.
I mean, I think there could be some tension down the road.
And then to Julie's point about your piece this morning, the last three governors, Bev Perdue, Mike Easley, and Jim Hunt, were all from the eastern part of the state. Now we have this guy from the great state of Mecklenburg in the mm-hmm. western part of the state. Will that make a difference? Pat McCrory has said, he said on this program, that he will govern the entire state. He won't be playing favorites to Charlotte.
Sure, and he said that very same thing last night. I said, hey, so what does this mean for Charlotte? And he says, this is a great thing for the entire state. but, you know, basically what people are saying is that, you know, what he will bring to the governor's office is this acquaintance with some of these urban issues as far as transit, you know, as far as zoning, as far as some of the infrastructure that cities, you know, deal with. Mm-hmm. He can ask these questions and look at it from an urban perspective.
One of the things that has impressed me about Pat McCrory over the years, and I've talked to him for many years, was that he really had a handle on what Charlotte was about and what we needed and the ins and outs of the minutiae of things that it takes to run a city like this. Is he up to speed on North Carolina? Because he's never served at a state office.
He hasn't, but he's been going all around the state for the last 4 years, yeah. Campaigning for this. So I think he's been talking to a bunch of state lawmakers. I think he's getting himself pretty acquainted.
So I don't think there'll be many vetoes coming from the governor's office in the next 4 years. But does this mean that we're likely to see tax cuts, or at least corporate tax cuts? Are we likely to see changes in education or education funding going forward?
I mean, on the tax cuts, I mean, that's a big part of what he ran on. I mean, one of his huge selling points was we need to be more competitive on a tax basis with our surrounding neighbors. We have a higher overall tax burden than all of our neighbors right around us. So, I mean, at least based on that being kind of a fundamental promise of his campaign, I would certainly expect that we're going to see some tax cuts in those regards.
And he, go ahead.
And with education, I mean, he has talked about some of the things that, you know, the state legislature actually has already passed as far as fourth grade reading being stressed and holding kids back who can't read by the end of the third grade. So I think you may see more of these changes that national Republican leaders have talked about.
Will this dual-track high school proposal that he puts forth get traction in the legislature? Because it requires the legislature, does it not, to make these things
that
happen?
That would require a lot of change. I mean, that is a very big structural change to basically have a two-degree track, one for college to get kids ready for college and another to get, you know, more of a vocational track. So, I mean, that would require a lot of effort, I think. And I haven't heard – I hear a lot of people talking about, oh, we need to have more vocational options in high school. But I haven't heard a lot of talk about specifically a vocational degree track.
Let's move to the congressional races because we had we have somebody deposed in the 8th District. Larry Kissel lost to Richard Hudson. And in the 9th, Sue Myrick's seat will go to fellow Republican Robert Pittenger, who won over Jennifer Roberts. Let's begin in the 8th with Larry Kissel and Richard Hudson. One of you was at Kissel headquarters last night. Which one was
mine? Yeah, that was great.
Go ahead. What was the atmosphere like? It couldn't have been good.
It wasn't really set up for a party, and then it was not a party. I mean, clearly. I mean, Kissel was there for about 7 minutes total last night. I mean, by the time he came in, the race had already been called. He gave a quick little speech and then left. And, you know, I mean, obviously, I mean, people there were very disappointed, but he kind of stressed that, you know, we went and did everything we said we were going to do for this district. It was always about the district. Mm-hmm. Clearly, he, you know, did not put like the Democratic big lines as a priority. I mean, he voted against some things that were big for them, for example, the passage of President Obama's health care law. But, you know, that district changed, and in this new district, I mean, he was facing a very tough battle to get reelected from the time that the state legislature controlled by Republicans redrew the maps last year.
Right.
Mike, just as an example, you know, if you look down at the different counties and how he did, two of the counties that they added, so they took away parts near like near Fayetteville, and they took away some of the more Democratic leaning voters in Charlotte, and then they gave that district parts of Davidson and Rowan County. If you dig down in there, those are the counties that gave Hudson, the Republican, his largest margins, if you go county by county. I mean, 69%, 74% of voters in Rowan County in that district voted for Hudson. So, you know, I mean, it was just an uphill battle
for
a Democrat. So
redistricting is what did Kissel in, you think, more than the fact – because he didn't support President Obama's policy on health care, among other things.
Right. Well, I don't think it was purely redistricting.
Okay.
I think, you know, Kissel himself has always admitted that he's not a great campaigner. He doesn't like to fundraise. I mean, he did it. He does it. But he's just really about representing the people. And so, you know, yeah. There was a lot going against him there.
Let's talk about the winner, Richard Hudson, Republican, conservative. Is he more conservative than the people in Congress already, or is he to the left of them or in the center of them? Where is he?
I would say cut from the same cloth. I mean, he had some Tea Party backing. He's clearly – I mean, he's been a congressional staffer essentially for Republicans over the years, and – run campaigns. I mean, compared to Kissel, he's a political animal for sure. And, you know, he had the conservative message. But I think most of all, he had the Republican voters that were just, you know, thrilled to have a Republican choice there on the ballot that they felt like, you know, they could go for and really get rid of a guy that, you know, that had been moderate, that met the needs of a lot of moderate folks in that district. But, you know, that I guess the changing times.
When we come back, we will take a look at who takes over for Sue Myrick. And that, of course, will be Robert Pittenger in the 9th Congressional District. And we'll bring in our two political scientists to talk about the presidential and Senate and House races elsewhere. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the law firm of Horak Talley, lawyers who work with clients to resolve disputes, handle complex business litigation, and protect clients' interests in court. Horak Talley, attorneys who get things done. And the Charlotte Symphony, Albert George Schramm, conducts a tribute to Benny Goodman, featuring clarinet phenomenon Dave Bennett and his septet, Friday and Saturday in Knight Theater. Tickets at 704-972-2000. Flu season is on the way, and although we will probably not have the shortages of vaccine that we had several years ago, we're going to find out what you need to know in this in the first part of our program about flu season, and maybe even some new delivery techniques for the flu vaccine that may take the pain out of it a bit. That's first, then the stars of Jekyll and Hyde, two-time Tony nominee Constantine Maroulis and multi-platinum R&B star Deborah Cox on their way to Broadway with a stop in Charlotte, and they join us tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, morning after analysis of the presidential election, a race last-minute polls suggest it was too close to call.
Join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon for Day After Election Analysis. That's here on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We've had our three of our WFAE news reporters, Michael Tomczyk, Julie Rose, and Lisa Miller, around this table talking about some local races, which we'll finish up on and add to the conversation with our two go-to guys, political scientists go-to guys, Dr. Eric Heberlig, Associate Professor of Political Science at UNC Charlotte, and Dr. Michael Bitzer, Associate Professor and Chair of the Department of History and Politics at Catawba College, as well as the force behind WFAE's Party Line Political Log, both back with us. Let's wrap up some of these local races. Pittenger against Jennifer Roberts in the 9th Congressional District, the Sue Myrick seat. Pittenger won. He spent a lot of money to do it, and he spent a lot of his own money to do it. Was it even close?
It was a lot closer than I think a lot of us expected. I mean, 52% to Pittenger to 46% to Jennifer Roberts. I mean, one of the closer races we haven't seen something that close in a long time in that district. Sue Myrick has traditionally won with huge, huge landslides.
And so, it's been a Republican district for years.
It has, and it got a little bit more Republican with the redistricting. But Jennifer Roberts won in Mecklenburg County. Pittenger took Iredell and Union County. And Jennifer Roberts really spent a lot of time running. You know, when I spoke to her last night, she said, you know, that she didn't regret running. Surely she could have chosen a more, I don't know, reachable goal, knowing that she was going into this heavily Republican district to try and run. But it just seemed like the right time and the right place. And she felt like she could really appeal to the nonpartisan sort of just American values in the community support, sort of the non-tangible she was talking about. It wasn't all just about Republican versus Democrat. And that's what she really tried to run on. I'm an American first, and I'm not a Democrat first. You know, it was often what had the message that she was giving. And she was very pleased with, you know, she was proud and humble, she said, and worked hard but enjoyed it. I loved every minute of it, she said, if you can believe that. I guess some people really love running in political campaigns. And then someone asked her, okay, well, you know, is this it for you? What will you do next? I mean, she's stepping off the county commission, obviously. She did not run for re-election there. And she said, well, you know, I'm not going to think about exactly what I'm going to do yet, but I'll just say that I'm young, I'm full of energy, and I love this community. So yeah. There will be more from Jennifer Roberts.
So we have two new Republicans locally. We have the 8th District winner last night over Larry Kissel, Richard Hudson, and we have Robert Pittenger. Characterize the two of them in terms of their political leanings as Republicans.
I think they're going to fit in nicely with the very conservative branch of the U.S. House Republicans.
Which remains Republican.
You know, you heard Hudson basically say, my first job is going to be to repeal Obamacare. And I think that's going to be the mantra. They're going to continue to fight that battle. Whether that's a wise political strategy or not, that's a different story. But it just seems like the two of them are very much within the guise of what is currently there, and they'll just reinforce the House Republicans.
Well,
already.
We will talk more about this later in the program, but you know, Americans seem to be very unhappy with Congress. They have historically low ratings from in terms of popularity. We are frustrated with gridlock and we want something to get done. And yet we elect a Democratic president, a Democratic Senate, and a Republican House, and we perpetuate gridlock. What's up with that?
Well, it's the other person who's creating gridlock. They're the ones who need to compromise. Yeah, I mean, our districts, as we've talked about already this morning, are drawn in such a way that it's increasingly difficult for someone from the other party to win them.
Is it time to rethink how we do that? Because it's highly political everywhere.
Well, I think you know the election results aren't all in from California, but we had some interesting results last night. California moved to a system where it's the top two vote getters in the primary who go to the general election. So in a number of districts that are safe for one party, you had two Democrats or two Republicans running against each other. And you had a couple longtime incumbents go down to challengers from within their own party last night. So I think that's the way you give some incentive for people to appeal to voters from the other party or to independent voters rather than just to the partisan extremes.
Before we go and spend the rest of the hour on national stuff, let's go to the county commission. Any surprises there? I know we picked up a Democratic seat and the Democrats regained control of the county commission.
Right. So the Democrats swept the three open seats, the three open at-large seats, picking up because in the last term they had a Republican Pendergraph in one of those three seats. So, and those three seats, Lisa, I guess you can add to this, are important because it's from those that they typically choose their chairman, right? So Democrats,
exactly.
So there will definitely be a Democratic chairman of the county commission,
and
I
that
think
has,
we can say.
And that has been historically, except for once in recent memory, the highest vote getter. And the highest vote getter this time by a shade was
Pat Cotham.
Pat Cotham, who would be new to the county commission.
All three of them are new. So you'll have I think it's four new faces on there. For this next upcoming county commission. And that's been a debate too. I mean, some incumbents, some people who have been on the county commission for a while say, hey, are we ready to have, a totally new person be, in charge of all of us?
Yeah. Well, is that it happens. It's happened in the past. And is the makeup of the county commission mostly new people now, or is it an even balance between returnees and new people?
It's
split, I think. Split,
yeah, it's four new and five old.
Something else that was a surprise, Mike, I was just going to add, I'm looking at the results from the District 6 Mecklenburg County. That's Bill James. Who we mentioned on this program a few days ago has traditionally not even had a challenger. And I mean, I was actually surprised to see that Connie Green Johnson, the Democrat, only lost by 10,000 votes. So she was 43% to Bill James's 56%, which is, a fairly good showing in a very typically pretty Republican district that has, Democrats have never really been able to mount a challenge to Bill James.
Except that Bill James, correct me if I'm wrong, doesn't campaign very much.
Right. But he hasn't had to. And he still wins by gigantic majorities.
So my question is then, if she's lost by 10,000 votes, is that because she was out campaigning and he wasn't? Or was it because people are beginning to lean Democrat or lean away from Bill James in that district?
Well, I think they ultimately elected Bill James. So,
But it was close.
It was close.
Okay.
Yeah.
We've had some scandals in recent months in the Mecklenburg County government. Is this going to be? Are these the kinds of things that are going to be addressed top of the page by an incoming county commission, or will all that stuff just slide into the background and these guys will come in with their new agenda, whatever it may be?
I mean, right now, as far as what they've been talking about leading up to the weeks. They've been talking about DSS and getting more transparency and the evals, the revaluations and things like that. So I think there's a lot of people where the revaluations are still smoldering, and I don't think they're gonna let them put them to the background. And you have this report coming out in a couple weeks, done by a consulting group, an independent group, looking at whether the revaluation was fair or not. That will come to the old county commission, but I think it'll be the new county commission that has to deal with it.
And I would not be surprised to see this new county commission, as they start to get their sea legs, these new members of the commission start to have some hard conversations about the balance of power and oversight of the county manager and how much they want to continue to feel comfortable letting him just sort of take care of and only report problems to them, or if they feel empowered to need to step in, because that is part of the discussion that's going on right now around DSS and around the county commission is supposed to be the oversight board of the Department of Social Services and of Youth and Family Services, child welfare, and yet they know very little typically about what's going on there as a commission.
I want to move to the presidential contest and the House and Senate races around the country and the complexion of the House and Senate. And I want to thank, before we even start, I want to thank Mitt Romney for making me very slow this morning, because he refused to concede for like 90 minutes last night, and I stayed up to the bitter end. So I should have gone to bed because we knew the outcome, but he wasn't going to admit it until, I guess, Ohio could be confirmed completely for him in his own mind. Was it a surprise, the outcome of this contest, at all to you guys?
I think the margin was a surprise to me. The fact that Obama basically swept the swing states, he's continuing to hang on to a small lead in Florida. I wouldn't have predicted that Florida would go to Obama. So in the Senate races as well, you saw a clear Democratic tilt to the result there. A number of states that voted overwhelmingly for Romney, like North Dakota and Montana, you have Democratic candidates who are hanging on to small leads there. So it was a much bluer night than I would have predicted.
I had just switched over to Fox, because I was flipping through all the networks last night, and I switched over to Fox at about 11:15 and heard them say that Ohio had put the president over the top and that he would be reelected. Did that surprise you that it came at 11:15? Because the race was so close, I really thought it would be, 9 o'clock this morning before we knew anything at all.
I mean, I think a lot of people in all the polls were indicating, I mean, it was a dead statistical tie between the two. And, you know, you started to see the early returns come in, and they constantly looked good. And the momentum just seemed to build throughout the evening that, boy, this is going to be a tough hill for Mitt Romney to climb, and he needed all the help he could possibly get and just didn't get it.
Yeah, I think the key for me was when they called Pennsylvania very early, which there were indicators that that had really closened up in the last week, and then, boom, they called it right away, and, well, then it's not so close.
And Virginia, too. I mean, Virginia was just, if Romney was going to have a good night, he needed Virginia, and he needed Virginia early. And
What put Virginia in the Obama column? Was it Northern Virginia, which is traditionally more Democratic?
It's the D.C. Beltline. It's those metro counties like North Carolina.
Outside of, yes.
I mean, you've got 13 counties that dominate this state.
Yes, because outside of Richmond, that's where all the people live, in Northern Virginia. And they are, having grown up in Northern Virginia, they are Virginia's great state of Mecklenburg, let me tell you. They really are. It's the same story exactly.
Well, and it's a much younger and more demographically diverse area of the state, which is the Obama coalition everywhere.
Now, North Carolina, President Obama carried it last time. He did not carry it this time. How close was it here?
Less than 100,000 votes.
Did that surprise you?
That I thought it was going to be tight. I didn't think it was going to be that tight. The late polls continued to show, but everybody was saying Romney's going to have the advantage. But it just felt in my gut, boy, this is going to be a lot tighter than we thought.
You think the president thought it was going to be that tight, because he had people, he had the first lady was here the day before Election Day.
You know, I can't help but think if he had come to this state maybe 2 days, maybe the weekend before the election, and
you
just
really
did
think that matters that
did
much,
the
really?
Visit.
I mean, they put the convention
10,
here.
10,000 more votes in the 10 most populous counties. If he had gone to Raleigh, if he had come to Charlotte.
And then it was in the Obama campaign just a calculus of return on investment, right?
Yeah.
Like how much do we really need? I mean, North Carolina, when they brought the Democratic National Convention here, there was talk, the Democratic Party leadership saying this is a sign that we're not giving an inch. We're going to win North Carolina again. We're going to win Virginia again. We're going to keep our lockdown here. And they had the Democratic National Convention. And then it was sort of like, okay, we gave it the best we could in North Carolina, and we're going to go focus on places where we feel like we really, really need to win. Yeah. North Carolina would be nice. And that's what the Democrats at the party I was at last night in Mecklenburg County. You know, these are Democrats who a lot of these people have worked day in and day out since October, knocking on doors, canvassing. They really wanted to see it happen, but it would have been just more of like an ego thing for them to feel like we pulled it out for him.
If I read the map in the paper this morning correctly, and if I remember it correctly, because I'm a little blurry-eyed to be honest with you.
We're there with you.
The president took Mecklenburg and Wake County, but he didn't take Durham County. Is that true?
No,
and if that's true, why? No,
he took Durham.
Okay, well, then I read it wrong.
He may not have taken Wake because he was behind there earlier in the evening.
All right. This was a very long campaign season, God knows. We saw all the gyrations of the Republicans in their primary season, and they finally settled on a candidate. The take on the political conventions was that the Democrats looked more excited, exciting, and engaged. The president got a little post-convention bump, went on to a disastrous performance in the first debate, got better in the second and third, but that bad performance helped Romney greatly. It erased the president's post-convention bump, gave Romney the one he failed to receive after the Tampa convention. Then Hurricane Sandy became the October surprise. Of all those things, what, if any of them, had the most impact?
What I find is remarkable is, with all those twists and turns, is the stability through the whole thing. I mean, if you look at the states that Obama won, it's pretty much the states he won 8 or 4 years ago. If you look at the coalitions, people voted pretty much the same way they did 4 years ago. You know, we've had a lot of storm and drong over the last 4 years to get to the same place.
And it was hard to get to the same place for him because there were a lot of people who were with him solidly in 08 who were not so sure this time around. And he thanked last night in his speech the greatest campaign team ever in the world ever. Was he right?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, the organization that the Obama for America campaign put together, I think, is something that we're going to be studying for a very long time, and is the new norm of modern campaigning. You were talking about yesterday the power of data mining,
right?
The power of micro-targeting. I mean, this is going to set the standard for all future campaign strategies and organizations, and it's not only going to impact the presidential races, it's going to filter down to the gubernatorial, to the Senate, to the House. We may even start to see things done at the local level that mirrors what is going on at the presidential level. It's a whole new day, and the coalition factor as well.
I mean, that's how you win 8 or 10 swing states when they're all within the margin of error in the polls. You get the right people to the polls to vote for you.
So as in any presidential campaign, we did have a lot of Sturm und Drang, but what does this outcome say about voters' feelings about the economy and about unemployment?
I think, one, it says, and the exit poll showed this last night, that they blame Bush for the economy. That was a core part of Obama's message. And the second part of it was that neither candidate really laid forth any detailed plan to do anything about it. So they had a choice between nothing and nothing. Okay. So you decide on other things.
So the president kept the office. The Democrats kept the Senate. The Republicans keep the House. But they didn't take the presidency, and they didn't pick up enough seats to take the Senate. And what does that say to the GOP?
The coalition of the GOP is much older, much whiter, much more male. And if they don't want to regionalize themselves, basically from South Carolina over to Louisiana, Arkansas, and then Idaho, Utah, they've got to start rethinking and base themselves back into reality of what the demographics of this country is going
through. Well, that's what Michael Steele, the former chairman of the Republican Party, says, because he also, I think he said this last night, that this might have been the last time that a win could have been squeezed out of white voters, which will not be possible going forward because there just aren't enough of them to make a winning coalition all by themselves.
Well, I think we see that the challenge in the Senate races. The Republicans in a number of states wanted other candidates. Their base chose the most conservative candidates, who then screwed up.
And we'll come back and talk more about that in a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the College Foundation of North Carolina, offering the North Carolina 529 College Savings Plan, one of many services helping families plan and pay for college. CFNC.org/NC529. And the Bechtler Museum of Modern Art, presenting architect Dion Neutra, son of influential architect Richard Neutra, discussing modern architecture and working with his late father. November 15th, details at Bechtler.org. If you're really into what we're talking about today, you should stay with us because you'll really be into what Diane Rehm is going to talk about at 10 o'clock in 20 minutes, the results of the presidential election. What a surprise. Can you imagine it? Stay with us. More to come on Charlotte Talk.
Well, it's all over, and behold the new political landscape in Washington. Republicans in the House, Democrats in the Senate, and President Obama in the White House for four more years. A brave new world, or more government dysfunction? We'll look ahead to the fruits of the 2012 election later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered from 4 to 6:30 on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR News source.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. I want to thank WFAE's Michael Tomsic, Julie Rose, and Lisa Miller for being with us in the first part of this program. Dr. Eric Heberlich from UNC Charlotte and Dr. Michael Bitzer with us now from Catawba College. We talked about the GOP having to rethink some things as a result of this election, not just because they lost the White House, but because they didn't regain the Senate. How do Republicans find a new constituency, because they campaigned in a way this time that I think cost them a lot of votes, particularly with women. So the role of young women in this election seems to have pushed Obama over the top because they were concerned about reproductive rights, which were they viewed them as being under attack by the GOP.
One of the interesting things coming out of North Carolina's exit polls was that women made up 56% of the electorate. 4 years ago, they were 54%. So obviously, they were concerned. They heard some messages. Now, granted, they split pretty evenly between the parties, but when you've got that kind of base already in the electorate and your message is kind of strident towards women, towards minorities, particularly the growing impact of Latino voters, you have to kind of think about ideology is important, but firm, passionate, oftentimes extreme ideology doesn't always work.
They also campaigned on not the Defense of Marriage Act, but they campaigned on traditional marriage values, mm-hmm. particularly in the primaries, the Republican primary. And I believe, if I'm not mistaken, four states last night passed gay marriage rights. In other words, they said okay to gay marriage in four different states last night.
Yeah,
the first time that those had passed. So yeah. That is really a confirmation of the rapid shift in public opinion we've seen on gay rights issues.
But at the same time, the GOP faced these struggles within their own party in terms of how to craft a message and find a new constituency. You have President Obama running for re-election in a bad economy with high unemployment. He repealed Don't Ask, Don't Tell. He bailed out the auto industry. He passed health care. What does this victory say about those policies and how America feels about them?
I think that speaks to, in part, to this notion that we're terribly gridlocked, that those are big accomplishments historically. Now, in terms of what had to pass Congress, that was during those first 2 years when Democrats controlled both houses of Congress, and you're not going to get a repeat of that type of legislative accomplishment in this divided Congress. But I think it speaks to the fact that people vented their spleen about it in the 2010 midterm elections. They elected a Republican Congress to check the excesses of the Obama White House. And now that there are indications of slow economic growth, and they didn't see an alternative that would make things demonstrably better, they were willing to stay with the president that they had and they basically trusted.
How much of this victory is the result of Obama's policies, his charisma, his ability to read the teleprompter, whatever you want to call it. I'm serious, whatever you want to call it, versus the fact that Mitt Romney didn't seem to stand for anything or seem to stand for everything, because even one Republican right-wing, very right-wing blogger said he looked back at his posts that he wrote about Mitt Romney when he was being vetted by John McCain to be the vice presidential running mate, and said that he could not find a single issue on which Mitt Romney did not have multiple positions.
I think the real struggle within the Republican primary for the 2016 nomination is going to start today. And there's a lot of soul searching, and there's going to be a lot of, do we want to continue with a pure, very firm ideologue that's going to present the policies and the principles that we believe in, or are we that appeals to a very shrinking segment of the electorate, or do we work to expand the opportunities? Chris Christie, for example, I mean, his name's going to be at the top of the list, I think, but some of the blowback may be what he did right before the election with embracing Obama and thanking the administration.
How much of that was because he thought he was going to be the running mate, and it didn't happen?
I don't think it was that. I think that's who Chris Christie is. I think he pulls no punches. I mean, he tells it like it is. The problem is going to be oftentimes the base of the Republican Party doesn't want to hear that. They want the purity. They want the ideological firmness.
Let's talk about this, because both of you have studied these parties over the years, and the parties have flipped positions more than once on a lot of key issues. I mean, Republicans essentially have become Democrats over time, and Democrats have become Republicans over time. How do you redefine yourself and not completely split apart?
I think in terms of the Republican Party redefining itself, it's going to take a Republican leader of national stature, particularly on something like immigration, because the party base has been resisting this. They resisted George W. Bush when he proposed immigration reform.
His brother, Jeb.
Perhaps his brother, Marco Rubio from Florida, to at least say to a faction of the party, look, we need to get this off the table.
Right.
We need to show that we're not completely hostile to Hispanics. And we realize that there's some portion of our base that's never going to be satisfied with that. You perhaps reach out to John McCain. He used to be for immigration reform. Lindsey Graham, you know, has to run again and is facing a primary challenge. But he's made noises again in the last couple of days that he's willing to reconsider this. You need Republicans with stature to take a lead on it and at least bring some Republicans over to make a deal.
ABC's Terry Moran called President Obama's win last night a liberal victory, pointing out that the president ran saying he would raise taxes on the wealthy, he came out for gay marriage, he came out for cutting defense spending, and he won. Do you agree that this was a liberal victory?
What surprised me more than about those issues was that the way abortion was handled. You think of even 10 years ago, Democrats were scared to death of abortion because it would drive working class whites away, Catholic voters away. This time Obama hammered it over and over again, trying to appeal to suburban women and figuring, I guess, that they'd already lost those working class white voters on abortion if they were going to lose them, and that it was worth mobilizing the young female voters. So it really was a risky move, I thought, that clearly paid off for him.
But he presented a solid framework for presenting it as women's rights, mm-hmm. women's choices. And I think that's, you know, if you get to frame the issue, you get to define for the other side how they're going to play against it. And I think that's what's coming in.
The president spent a lot of time in his first two years trying to reach across the aisle to no avail. And he mentioned this last night, that he was going to reach across the aisle. And there are a lot of Democrats who are just sick and tired of him trying to reach across the aisle because he hits a brick wall every single time. So was that just rhetoric last night? In this second term, would that change? Should that change?
It's got to change. If you want anything done, there are 60 votes in the Senate does not exist to break a filibuster. So what these folks are going to have to do is to say, I'm not going to get everything I want. I am going to have to use, and this is going to be the key term, compromise. And you're going to have to speak to your base. You're going to have to speak to those Democrats who say you're not liberal enough. You're going to have to speak to your, to the Republicans who say you're not conservative enough. And you're going to have to say, folks, get over yourselves. You're going to have to work in the middle.
That doesn't seem to work because, you know, John Boehner, who's the Speaker of the House, even if he wanted to work with the president in the last 4 years, really had, was hamstrung by the party, the Tea Party wing of the Republican Party. Doesn't that continue with this because they maintain control?
Sure it does. It does, but we have this fiscal cliff that's hanging over our head in December, so that they have to come up with at least some way to you know, I suspect part of it will be kicking the can down the road a little bit, but they all know they have to reach some type of agreement on this.
So it's the president who no longer has to worry about being reelected, then simply stand up and say, look, this is how it is. We have to be grown-ups here.
Use the power of the bully pulpit.
Will he do that? Can that be effective? Can the president say it's their fault because they won't talk and you need to call your congressman right now and have them come to the table? Can he do that? Will he do that? Is he the kind of guy that can do that?
I think it's more the policy substance that he has to put on the table credibly for the Republicans, that I'm willing to cut Medicare. I'm willing to talk about Social Security. I'm willing to take on the entitlements that are key concerns for you and is going to outrage my base.
Yeah, well, it does go both ways, doesn't it? Because he's got to be able to say, okay, I'll make some compromises here. But so do you.
Yeah.
But he doesn't face reelection. This was his last campaign.
Sure.
Everybody else under him faces reelection.
Including Democrats in the Senate who are winning those red states.
Can he corral them? Or will they be just as obstinate as the other side?
Well, we've got a midterm election.
He doesn't like to work with people, evidently. I mean, he says he does. He likes to reach across the aisle. But, you know, when you look at some of the things that he passed, like health care, mm-hmm. he pushed health care. And then he said to the Congress, here, you work this out. I mean, can you do that and be successful?
It's leadership. And he's got to exercise it. He has nothing to lose right now except in the midterms and for a potential setup for 2016.
My question. Did he not do it last time because he wanted to be a two-term president? And he was not deaf. He heard Mitch McConnell say, our goal here is to make this man a one-term president. So he pulled his cards in close to the vest to live for another 4 years. And now
– maybe he's liberated.
Change.
Yeah. He could be very liberated and say, this is what I want to go after. This is going to be my legacy beyond health care.
Heather in Belmont writes, you asked what the election says about what voters think about the economy. I think it's clear that the voters think poverty, education, health care, disaster relief, etc. are more important than slow economic growth. The growth will come, but severe tax cuts and reduced spending are outweighed by other considerations.
I never overestimate the policy statements that Americans are making when they vote. It's typically not much about policy, unfortunately.
Conga Chile writes on our website, Republicans have only themselves to blame. Their embrace of the most extreme right elements of the party show a failed path for the country that the majority is not willing to go along with, and Romney's last-minute pivot to the middle didn't convince enough gullible voters to allow him to win. Sadly, Pat McCrory's and North Carolina's shift to the right by endorsing Pittenger, Hudson, etc., put us more on a par with states like Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana, and a race to the bottom. In fact, the South now has only one Democratic governor.
Yes, but I think this election confirms to me that North Carolina is moving much closer to what Virginia is going to be like than South Carolina. I think the racial demographics and everything else is significantly changing. And Republicans can you know, hold on to power because they've got the power of redistricting under their belt. They've set themselves up. But you can't change the influx of people coming in. You can't change who's being born in this state. And appealing to that growth is going to be critical if the Republicans in the future want to continue to hold.
Christy in Concord writes, why does the media believe the Republican polls when the numbers don't add up? Karl Rove kept saying how Romney – I was just going to bring this up. Karl Rove kept saying how Romney would win a mandate. He said, I think, a landslide. Mm-hmm. Pretending you are going to win doesn't make you a winner. Yet many Republicans I know are surprised that the out of touch with the people Romney lost because of the fairy world that they – are told on Fox News that they would be in a mandated majority. Will the Republican Party change Fox News type of reporting to get back to reality? It isn't just Fox News. And Bill Maher points this out on his show all the time, that the Republicans live in a bubble. This has – and I'm not sure that's necessarily fair – but this election campaign seemed to be replete with an enormous number of absolute abject falsehoods being told, the latest of which was that commercial that the Romney campaign ran in the Midwest about Jeep Obama selling Chrysler to China, a company he does not own. And then they're taking all of their Jeep production to China, which Chrysler came out and said was abjectly wrong. And then General Motors got into the conversation and said, no, it's a lie. Why would you do that? Will we see a shift away from lies or facts as you believe them being the facts?
No, I think we saw a lot of it this election. We saw it consistently.
And it happened on both sides. I don't want to be painted unfair.
It happened
on both sides.
And that suggests to me that both sides thought they were perfectly safe in doing it. And there was consistent pushback from fact checkers in the media, and it didn't matter. They kept repeating the same stuff over and over.
One of them said, "We're not going to be dictated to by fact checkers."
Exactly.
What universe are all of us living in?
One that we have confirmed what we want to believe.
Exactly. We only.
What does that say about the future?
Continued polarization.
Has it been like this in the past? In the past, because you know we think that the current time is worse. But if you look back at newspapers from the early 20th century and certainly around the Civil War, mm-hmm. they were blisteringly awful to the candidates on both sides. So putting out their own set of misinformation.
Yeah, I think the difference now is with the web and technology like that. There are more sources. There are more ways to limit your information to only what you want to hear and what confirms your view. And you have more of those bubbles. You don't have to have the ability to print a newspaper to get those type of messages out.
Dr. Eric Heberlig from UNC Charlotte, Dr. Michael Bitzer, get some rest from Catawba College. Thank you all for being here.
Thank you.